I actually had a suggestion. Do you want me to quickly give you a very quick rundown on the national, the NDIS quality and safeguarding framework? Because I have it in my hand, and I could just give everybody a brief outline of what I know about it.
That would be fantastic. Okay. We've got 20 minutes. For those of you who don't know, this is Mary Mallett, and she comes all the way from Canberra, from Dana. Welcome.
Yep. Thanks. Oh, sorry, I actually only knew a couple of days ago that I was going to be able to come today, so I didn't even get a name badge. So this is my copy of the Quality and Safeguarding Framework, and I've put all these coloured stickers on it about advocacy-related issues. So I don't know if has anybody in the room had time to read this yet? No. It came out a couple of weeks ago. It's not actually out for comment. It's out as it is. It's a funny document. It reads like it's been written by a committee, because it probably has. And there's some funny things in it. But the basics are that... So there's kind of 18 months to go, more or less, for this to get put in place. They're starting to write the legislation now. They'll have two lots of legislation, primary and secondary legislation. But the new functions that will exist nationally is a new complaints commissioner, an NDIS complaints commissioner. There'll be a registrar who's responsible for service providers having to register under them. So, like was mentioned a minute ago, there's what exists now, and then there's what will exist once all of this new stuff's put in place. So there's a kind of a transition phase over the next 18 months to 2 years, where all the existing systems in all the states and territories stay exactly the same, or like in Victoria, improve. And I'm not entirely clear, I must say, what happens when this thing is fully rolled out, then what happens to the existing state and territory structures and bodies. I'm not entirely clear. So there's a few weird things in here, which is that they describe the functions that this new quality and safeguarding system will have. They don't describe yet the body that they will sit in. Now, we don't know, it's not clear whether the decision hasn't quite yet been made, so the questions I still have and I'm trying to find out is where the kind of stuff that advocates need to know, which is where is the power and the accountability for this, all of this new stuff? Will it sit directly under the federal minister, for instance? Will it report to COAG? Who will it report to? So that's a thing that's not clear yet. I suspect probably to the minister, federal minister. So there'll be this new complaints commissioner, and complaints about the NDIS will go to that complaints commissioner. So they'll have own motion powers, they'll have investigation officers, whatever they'll call them. And that'll be complaints about NDIS funded services, whether they are registered with the NDIS or not registered. So people who are self-managing with their NDIS funding, and who you can use anybody, whether they're registered providers or not, the complaints about the people they use will still go to that complaints commissioner. Complaints about the NDIA itself, though, won't. They'll have to go to the Commonwealth Ombudsman. And I think this is odd, the complaints about the local area coordinators will also not go to the NDIS Complaints Commissioner. I don't understand why. I've asked several times and I don't get a response that makes sense to me. They say, oh yes, well they're contracted by the NDIS. Well, so what? You know, I don't understand. They're contracted all over the country to all different organisations, charities and others. I don't understand why complaints about them will not go back to that complaints commissioner, because there will be plenty of complaints about them, you know, mainly that they're ineffective, which is what we're hearing from lots of advocates all over the place, that the LACs don't know what they're doing, have to ask the advocates how to do their job, and, you know, some of them are. That's understandable when it's a new system. And, you know, they'll catch up, I'm sure. But the very peculiar thing, and I queried it this morning and they're going to follow it up for me, is complaints about local area coordinators do not come under that new complaints commission, but complaints about advocates, would you believe, do. Now, that's completely nonsensical. If you look at the total workload of most advocacy organisations, issues to do with the NDIS, especially once the system is fully in place, might be 10 or 15% of their workload. And all their other issues will be justice, health, education, child protection, all the other issues. So why on earth complaints about those organisations dealing with all those issues would come under the NDIS Complaints Commissioner? It makes no sense. I have a feeling, well, the only thing I can think of is that for the federally funded advocacy organisations, the place where complaints about them currently goes to is the CRRS. Now, I presume what that means is they're dismantling that and therefore rolling it into the new Complaints Commission. Anyway, I'm trying to get an answer about that. So there'll be the Complaints Commissioner, there'll be this Registrar who will, it's where service providers sit under the Registrar. So the Registrar will do all the registering of the new, of any new providers. So that's a new national function. The worker screening, I had presumed was going to sit sort of with that, and it kind of does, but it's not really a new national function. The worker screening will actually just continue to be what happens in all the states and territories, but maybe harmonised a bit more. So there's a mixture in this new national NDIS quality and safeguarding framework of things that are new national responsibilities and other things that just are the same blend of state and territory functions as previously. And the other one that's like that is there's going to be a national senior practitioner. So the national senior practitioner will deal with restrictive practices, but in a limited way. They're designed to be like a model of good practice. So they will provide good examples of positive behaviour support. They will kind of lead that area, but service providers who want to get permission to put restrictive practices in place will still have to do that authorisation through their state or territory senior practitioner or whatever the role is. It's not called the same thing everywhere. So that again, that's something I was a bit surprised at, and some of these things we'll just have to see how they play out. That's a slightly odd one though, to have the authorisation of restrictive practices still sit in state and territories, but the national senior practitioner, I don't know, do what exactly? Run around the country telling people how to do the job? I don't know. What became clear to me after I read through it and we had a briefing about it was we've been waiting for this to come out, thinking this was the answer to everything, and of course it's not. It's just another Commonwealth framework that, you know, hopefully will make things better, but it's not the solution to everything. But one of the things that is clear in here that I am paying attention to is there are some indications of risks to advocacy. I've got lots of circles in here. Page 34 is one of them, which says that some of the supports the NDIS funds through individual plans and ILC capacity building overlap with some supports traditionally provided by advocacy services. The National Disability Advocacy Program, because they are just thinking of the federal one, but of course this equally applies to all the state-funded ones as well. So it needs to be further developed to ensure it's complementary to the supports and safeguards made available through the NDIS. Now, and we've had other indications through other unofficial sources that this is an issue. There appears to be a kind of a belief somewhere. It's not clear because it's not really in writing, but it exists, that the work that advocates do will be replaced by what the local area coordinators do. Now, of course it won't, but the risk still exists, and it's actually, to be honest, it's about the money. So the federal government when the NDIS is fully rolled out, will be spending $550 million a year on local area coordination. And in the same way that they don't want to duplicate anything in any systems, they don't want to duplicate that stuff either. So if they actually believe, or make themselves believe, that what the local area coordinators do will cover off on what advocates do, then advocacy funding is potentially at significant risk, and we're getting some indications along that line, and we will be we're starting the very beginnings of planning a national campaign to kind of protect advocacy funding, which we will probably have to roll out everywhere except in Victoria. There's some other things, again on page 35, if you remember, the National Disability Advocacy Framework came out for consultation probably 2 years ago. Some of the organizations in the room wrote submissions. There were lots of good submissions went in for that framework. And then after that, the review of the program itself happened, and that's still underway. But the framework went into a black hole in DSS and never reappeared. Now, it has to be agreed by COAG, and it hasn't yet been. I'm not sure why. There is the National Disability Advocacy Principles out of that framework. So this is the first bit we've seen publicly anywhere, and they're calling it a transitional framework. Now, you can read that in one of two ways, really. It could be transitional to a new effective framework once once the NDIS is rolled out, and that'd be a good thing. If you were reading it in a pessimistic frame of mind, you could read it as transitional to nothing, you know, transitional to when advocacy isn't needed anymore. And we know that that view is held by some people in the federal system anyway. Not by the people who run the advocacy program, actually. They are strong supporters of advocacy, but by other people for whom the money is the issue. So when you are paying attention to this, if it comes up, just be aware of that we have to take seriously this stuff that looks like risks to advocacy. It's feeling to us like they're genuine risks. And they already exist because of the state funding. I'll just give you an example of that. So the total federal money that's spent on the advocacy program is $16.5 million. And then they spend another about $3 million on print disability. So it's about 19 point something million on advocacy. But if you look, the total figure that's spent on it's advocacy information and print disability is the category, the big category, and inside that is the independent advocacy funding, but also lots of other things. Lots of other organizations get some funding for systemic advocacy. So that the total amount of money is actually 64 point something million dollars a year is spent in that category of information, advocacy information and print disability, of which less than 20 million is Commonwealth and the rest is state and territory. So 10.9 million is New South Wales. All of that, every dollar of it, is due to disappear in a year's time. Queensland, 13 million, I think, due to disappear the year after. Victoria, I think, is 9 point something million in total. And the smaller states and territories, it's, you know, 1 and 2 million, that kind of money. What we're doing right at the minute is trying to put together a really detailed list of exactly where that money is spent. Because for DANA and the independent advocacy sector, our focus has to be on protecting the funding for the independent advocacy organisations on the ground. And we can't, because we haven't got the capacity or the energy or the time to actually necessarily protect all of the systemic advocacy funding that has gone traditionally to a whole range of other organisations. We can try and build alliances and stuff, but we have to focus on our core business. And our core business is on the ground independent advocacy. As I said earlier on, in Victoria, that is not under threat, but you are the only state where it's not under threat. It's really crisis situation in the other states. No acknowledgement at all by politicians anywhere that that's an issue or a problem. So it's distressing, really, that the advocates who are part of the safeguarding system and who in the Victorian work are completely acknowledged as such. In the national one, there's a section on advocacy. Advocacy is acknowledged as being important, that it's funded. You know, they only, because it's federal, they only think about the DSS stuff and they don't think at all about the state funding. So they just, you know, put it to one side and say, yes, it's important, yes, it's funded. But there's a lot of work to be done this year to persuade a whole lot of decision makers of the role of advocates and what they do. And it reminds me, really, that probably because advocates spend all their time fighting for the issues that their clients have. So that's where their energy goes. They're advocating and fighting all the time to get outcomes for their clients on whatever the issue is, abuse or transport or whatever it is. But with very little attention paid to themselves and actually advocates when they're they mostly, you know, the traditional, you know, stand before, or, you know, that stuff, and advocates do that, but without, like, part of their job is to not put themselves forward and say, oh, look at me, aren't I great, aren't I a brilliant advocate, you know, shouldn't I get a pat on the back? They don't do that because it's not their role, it's not their job, and it's not the type of people usually that work in advocacy. Other parts of the sector do that all the time. The service provider part of the sector, they have communications people and marketing people, especially as the NDIS is coming in, they're spending money on that. Look how great we are. Look at the brilliant programs we can provide for you. So at a time when advocacy is needed more than ever, the small, under-resourced advocacy sector is sitting somewhere in a little hidden corner, unacknowledged, invisible to most people. The service providers have got the hang of selling themselves now to everybody, and they've got, you know, great, fantastic posters and brochures and banners and, you know, human rights stuff, and, you know, they're looking brilliant. And advocacy is almost is a potential risk of disappearing almost completely around the country. And it's mind-boggling, really. And, you know, to be able to speak in Victoria, where that's where it's not at risk, you know, is fantastic. But, you know, I was in Sydney last week meeting with the Sydney organisation, and the week before meeting with the New South Wales advocacy organisations, and then at a teleconference with the Queensland ones. None of them know what to do. They just are, you know, they've tried over the last couple of years. They've all met with their minister. They've pushed it as far as they can, and they have just been pushed back, saying, "Go, you'll be a Commonwealth responsibility, go and talk to the Commonwealth," or being told you'll be covered, funded under the ILC. Now, the first round of ILC funding has come out, so there's ACT grants, and there's one round of national funding. Advocacy is deliberately excluded in three different ways. It's written in the guidelines for those grants that you cannot be funded to do advocacy under ILC funding. So advocacy organisations can apply for the funding to do capacity building, which is some of what you do anyway, but you have to kind of not mention the word advocacy. I was at a National Peaks meeting last week and joking, you know, that DANA would have to change its name to DNA instead of Disability Advocacy Network. We'd just be, you know, Disability Network Australia. And then it occurred to me that DNA also stood for definitely not advocacy. So, you know, I mean, it's a joke, but it's not funny. It is really a challenge at a time when the very word advocacy is not popular with the federal government. And we can't pretend we do anything other than what we do. We're your advocacy organisations, that's what you do. But the NDIS won't fund what you do, it's so. Other than in Victoria, there is a crisis around the country in advocacy. And the one last thing before I finish depressing you completely is around decision support, because that's the other. You know, as the NDIS came in, you know, DANA and other advocates argued, you know, you could very well say we shot ourselves in the foot. We argued for advocacy to be kept outside of the NDIS, so it could remain independent. What we didn't we were too naive, I think, and we didn't understand that potentially what that might mean is we would stay outside and then disappear because there'd be no money. We presumed we'd stay outside and there'd be lots of money. Anyway, one of the things that the NDIS will fund is, you know, they fund things that look, they call them advocacy type activities, and they're under support coordination, and a tiny handful of the advocacy organisations around the country, only three or four, have registered to do support coordination, to try and get in and do some of that work that is a bit like advocacy, but is funded by the NDIS and is not advocacy. Well, I was talking to one of them in the ACT yesterday. So she has now seen a line item in a few people's plans that is about supported decision making. But it's not the kind of supported decision making that advocates might be helping people with. You know, significant decisions about getting their money back from, you know, getting control of the finances back from the public trustee, or you know, changing where they live, you know, or it's more like what you have for breakfast. It's in actual fact what it is good support work. And somehow the NDIS is confusing this, and is what it seems is they're starting to just fund support providers to do what they should be doing anyway as part of their work practice, but they've given it this name, which is, you know, about decision support or supported decision making, which is actually more what advocates do. Proper support, you know, giving people credible, unbiased, informed, you know, information that they can then make informed choices about, and supporting them to make those choices. All of that stuff that's part of the practice of advocacy is now being diminished somehow and stuck in under the NDIS, and advocates can't get the money to do it, but service providers can. So there are battles all around, that, and we will be looking for examples from some of you about as you are seeing these things arising, especially as the NDIS rolls out in your areas. Sorry, one last thing I just remembered, which is one of the things that we are doing right now, we're just starting it, is we're commissioning a group of economists in Canberra to do a piece of work on a cost-benefit analysis of advocacy. There isn't one in existence. It hasn't been done before anywhere. We'd been trying to get DSS to fund it, but the timelines take too long, and anyway, the advocacy sector needs to own the information, actually. So Dana doesn't have the money to pay for it. We are literally asking advocacy organisations to provide some funding, and we've just about got enough money at the moment, almost tied it down. So they'll be starting it next week. They're going to take 3 months to do it, so we'll have this thing in May sometime. It's a proper costed piece of work. They'll be coming out to all the advocacy organisations, looking at the publicly available information that's in your annual report, so to gather how much money is spent on advocacy, but then looking at the outcomes and how much money advocacy saves across different systems. The end result will be, you know, could be down as a single sentence, you know, a dollar spent on advocacy saves whatever, you know, however much money. We don't know. We'll have to wait and see. But anyway, we've been wanting to do this for a long time, and our kind of desperation this year, and we have coincidentally happened to find these economists who are available to do it. So you'll be hearing more about that, and you'll get contacted by us and also by this group of economists to provide some information to feed into it. So I hope you all cooperate. And thanks for that. It was nice to come down and connect today with the Victorian sector.
Thank you, Mary. I'm really pleased you decided to discuss that framework. I've spent a lot of time trying to read through the whole 104 pages, and it's just a great the way you summarised it in a way that we can all understand. If anyone has any questions for Mary, now's your opportunity. Nothing? Okay, so we're about 7 minutes away from lunch, so I'm happy for you to have your lunch break early. The food hasn't arrived yet, but just, feel free to mingle, it won't be long, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock. Thank you.